This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit Mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.
Trump has risen to Reagan's level in the eyes of many conservatives. And I know that might stun a lot of the audience, but if Trump wins re-election, he will be at the same level as Reagan, I think, in the minds of a lot of Republicans.
Hello, and welcome to the Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I am Jane Kosten. I am senior politics reporter with a focus on conservatism and the GOP. And today I have a very interesting conversation with Matthew Continetti. He is editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon, a conservative publication based in D.C. He is very thoughtful and knowledgeable about the intellectual history that has provided the backbone of the conservative movement as we know it. We talked about Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump, the beginnings of the new right, what neoconservatism was, is, and isn't, and a host of other subjects, and I thought it was a really interesting and informative conversation. As always, you can email the show at EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. And without further ado, here is Matthew Continetti. Matthew Continetti, welcome to the podcast. First and foremost, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and the research you're doing on the history of intellectual conservatism?
Sure. Well, I'm the editor of the Washington Free Beacon. It's a conservative online newspaper. We founded it in 2012. Before that, I was a writer and editor for the Weekly Standard magazine, now defunct. But I had done that since I graduated from Columbia in 2003. And I found that I had a special characteristic while I was at the Weekly Standard. I was the only member of the staff who had read every issue of the Weekly Standard because they had these beautiful set of bound volumes. And trying to familiarize myself with my craft, I went through them all and thus developed an interest in the history of the conservative intellectual movement, which is really now in its, I guess if you date it with the publication in America of The Road to Serfdom in 44, 45, it's now almost 75 years old.
So you take it from The Road to Serfdom. I think a lot of people, when you think about a figure, say like William F. Buckley, they date it to God and Man at Yale. Mm-hmm. Though it's interesting that you talked about you started at the Weekly Standard. Were you a Collegiate Network fellow?
I was, yes. It's a funny thing. At Columbia, we didn't have a Collegiate Network paper. And the Collegiate Network, of course, is a network of conservative campus papers. So, in fact, the main paper at Columbia, the Columbia Spectator, was affiliated with the Collegiate Network. And that's how I became plugged into that organization. I also contributed to their national magazine, which was called Campus Magazine. And so CN very generously funded me for my first year at the Weekly Standard. And a little bit before that expired, I was promoted or hired permanently on the staff.
So I was also a Collegiate Network fellow.
Well, congratulations. We can have the secret handshake now.
Yes, exactly. And the reason why I bring this up is that something that I think for a lot of folks observing conservatism and the world of conservatism from outside its boundaries is that our experience of being kind of brought into, via the Collegiate Network and a lot of other organizations, being brought into the conservative movement via a very distinct recruitment process is not that unusual. And I've been talking a lot this week about conservatism, as I talk a lot about conservatism all the time, every day, for my entire life. And that conservatism, I think, in many ways, is a movement. It's a movement. It's not just a set of ideas or an ideology. It is a movement. Can you talk about how the ideology of conservatism and the movement of conservatism relate to one another?
Well, that's a great question. One thing my studies and reading has shown me is that it's very difficult to speak of conservatism as just a monolithic ideology. In fact, from the very beginning, there have been competing definitions of what a conservative is or what he or she believes in. A lot of these questions were kind of solved by the foundation of National Review in November 1955. And for many decades, National Review was, as they like to say, the only game in town in terms of kind of propagating or communicating what a conservative consensus was. And that clearly is no longer the case. But the conservative movement, the political expression of some of these ideas, really kind of came into being shortly after the foundation of National Review. I kind of date it to 1960, which was the Organization of Young Americans for Freedom and the publication of their founding charter, the Sharon Statement. Sharon, Connecticut is where it was signed on the front lawn of Bill Buckley's family home where he grew up. And that same year in 1960 sees the publication of Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative. And so Goldwater becomes really the central political figure of conservatism. At that time, he inherits the title from the deceased Senator Robert Taft. And he is the one who tells the convention in 1960, let's grow up conservatives, and eventually wins the nomination 4 years later.
So it's interesting that you bring up Goldwater, because I think Goldwater was such a defining figure within the conservative movement, despite the fact that he lost tremendously badly in 1964. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One, I think I write a lot about African-American conservatives. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of Black conservatives who attended the 1964 Republican National Convention, and Goldwater basically making a states' rights argument against civil rights legislation, and the experiences of, say, legends like Jackie Robinson, who attended the 1964 Republican National Convention and had people trying to start fights with him, which seems, on a side note, like a bad thing to attempt to do, as he was a very large, very strong, legendary baseball player. And it's interesting also that Goldwater legacy continues. I wrote a piece this week about CPAC, and the first CPAC in 1974 is a group of conservatives who are very upset at Richard Nixon, not just because of Watergate, but because he's not adequately conservative. They wanted Ronald Reagan this whole time. Ronald Reagan, they wanted him to run in 68. They'd wanted him to run in 72. That's not what happened. Can you talk a little bit about Goldwater's positionality in the movement? Because I think that now, as we observe conservatism, I think a lot of people are like, what happened to the party of Ronald Reagan? What happened to kind of that legacy? But for older conservatives, they were looking to Reagan as someone of one of their peers, but they were looking, we want to be the party of Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, the joke is that Goldwater lost the 64 election, but it took 16 years to count the votes. And so Goldwater's defeat in 64, in a way, was a harbinger or a necessary loss to pave the way for Reagan's victory in 1980. Goldwater's vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is a burden that conservatism in America has had to carry ever since. This was a fraught decision on his part, actually. It was one title, the public accommodations title, that he objected to, led to his vote against it. Later in his life, said how much he regretted that decision, but there's no question that even, as you say, at the moment of the convention, his position there, which really ran against the civil rights tradition in the Republican Party, was a defining and contested moment. Goldwater, later in his life, became more libertarian.
Right. He was talking a lot about gay people in the military when he was, living in Arizona in the early 1990s.
He became a cultural libertarian. He had always been a kind of an economic one. But he was a very kind of cantankerous person, charming in his way. And but I think by the end of his life, he had kind of alienated himself from the conservative movement at that point in late 80s, 90s, which had taken on a very socially conservative, even religious cast. And so by the time of his death in 1998, conservatives had various views of him, even though they agreed that he was really kind of the one of the central political figures, next to Reagan, really, the most important political figure in American conservatism up until that point.
There seems to be a quest towards kind of a pure ideal of conservatism, which leads itself to purity spirals. I'm going to read you a quote. When William F. Buckley began National Review, some of his efforts were based on kind of not just defining what conservatism is, but defining what conservatism is not. So part of that involved frowning upon Alabama Governor George Wallace for being an obstinate segregationist, though Buckley's own racial past is questionable. Part of that was discussing Ayn Rand, who he thought was an overly bellicose atheist. And a part of that was also talking about the John Birch Society, which was among the more paranoid right-leaning organizations of its time and still continues to be today. And when National Review repudiated John Birch Society, one of Buckley's letters that he received was, "I've always believed you to be a true conservative. However, since you seem categorically to accept most of the left-wing programs, I'm beginning to doubt your sincerity." And it seems to me that as conservatives debate with one another about the one true conservatism, the one true faith, so to speak, it seems to be that even while we're starting to have the influence of conservative populism, there's still this overarching drive to be more conservative or to find whatever is truly conservative or pure conservatism. You saw that with Mitt Romney going to CPAC in 2012 and describing himself as being severely conservative, to which, Rush Limbaugh and a bunch of folks kind of in conservative media were like, "No, you're not. We remember when you were in Massachusetts doing..." Obviously, the drive for purity in movements is not uncommon, but it seems to be a very specific type of call to purity that happens within conservatism.
Well, on one level, it's a call to purity, which, as you say, does happen in all movements and often happened in communist movements in America. The sectarianism of the Marxist socialist movement in America, there are whole volumes written about it. So that is common to movements in general, the sense that, well, if you don't agree with me on everything, you need to start your own group. Irving Kristol had a line he liked to say, which is, "You can't split rotten wood," which is that these disagreements and even divisions represent vitality of the movement. But I also think it stems from something deeper, which relates to to your first question and our first discussion, which is, no one really knows what conservatism is.
Yes.
And from the very beginning, there was a lot of arguments. In fact, Friedrich Hayek, so I mentioned how I kind of date it, and I was following my tutor George H. Nash in this, but I date it with the publication of Road to Serfdom. But later, after encountering some of the new conservatives, such as Russell Kirk, Hayek writes an essay, "Why I Am Not a Conservative." And so is the classical liberalism represented by Hayek and von Mises and Milton Friedman really conservatives? Well, Buckley thought so, because I have a quote in my notes from 1971 where Buckley says that my conservatism is the conservatism of the two most recent, or rather 1977 maybe, two most recent Nobel laureates, Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman. So that suggests a much more classically liberal conservatism. Is it the social conservatism that really came into being in the 1970s, this against the social policies of the expanding welfare state? Well, neoconservatives, while being on the side of the social conservatives in regards to social policies affecting the family and religion, were much more comfortable with the welfare state in principle. as a means of providing public goods, such as pensions, unemployment insurance, even health insurance in the case of Erin Crystal. So these types of arguments, we brought up 64 in the Civil Rights Act. One of the most important conservative thinkers, Harry Jaffa, who helped write Barry Goldwater's nominating speech, also was an intense believer in the Equality Clause of the Declaration of Independence and supported the 64 Civil Rights Act. And Brent Bozell, who was Buckley's brother-in-law, famously took issue with Buckley's defense, infamous and rightly so, defense of segregation, written in National Review in 1957. So there are all these contested issues. There was always these debates within the conservative movement. There was, for many years, a column in National Review called The Open Question, where all of these various thinkers could kind of duke it out. The question then arises, which is, what held them together? And I think fundamentally, it was an opposition to communism abroad and then to a sort of intrusive liberalism at home. But even there, they had people who were not part of the, say, conservative consensus as represented by National Review, who were criticizing them on those grounds as well.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile's whole deal is pretty simple. They sell premium wireless services totally online. And they say that by cutting the cost of retail, they can pass all those savings on to you. Switching to Mint Mobile means saying goodbye to an overpriced monthly plan or unexpected fees. You can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. That includes unlimited talk and text plus high-speed 5G data. You could even bring your own phone number to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT costs and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area.
Let's shift forward a little bit, because I think that something for people who have been observing conservatism or thinking about conservatism is the degree to which neoconservatism has fallen. I'm not sure if it was really in favor exactly, but how much other conservatives have taken issue to neoconservatives and, so to speak, neocons. And I think that that is something that, in my view, really began to arise with the shifting perception of the Iraq War. Specifically, you know, you start seeing this in like 2005, 2006, not just coming from folks on the left, because I think people on the left had been long calling Bill Kristol and others who they viewed as calling for this war as being warmongers, so to speak. But then you start seeing it from conservatives. And obviously, there have been branches of conservatism, you know, paleoconservatives and others who have long spoken out against American intervention overseas. But the distaste for which much of the modern conservative movement, and specifically kind of Trumpian conservatives, have for neocons is really stark and somewhat overwhelming. So first, I'd love you to talk a little bit about neoconservatism, because I think, you know, there's that famous quote that a neoconservative is a liberal who's been robbed by reality. And neoconservatism, in some ways, began with a lot of folks who thought of themselves as being liberals, but then saw the events of the late 1960s and early 1970s and just kind of had this view that, you know, liberalism had left them behind, in a sense. So first, I'd love you to talk a little bit more about neoconservatism and how neoconservatism has been positioned now, especially it seems to be an unpopular line of thought, so to speak.
Right. Well, just as with conservatism, we need to start breaking down what we mean when we talk about neoconservatism. The way I kind of categorize it is by looking at the three chief neoconservative publications, and each of them represents a different iteration. Indeed, in some cases, a different generation of neoconservatism. And so let's start at the beginning. And that is with The Public Interest, which was the magazine co-founded by Irving Kristol and Daniel Bell in 1965. It was a quarterly that published until 2005. This was the original neoconservative publication. Bell, Kristol, and their friend and contributor and later co-editor with Kristol, Nathan Glaser, who was recently deceased, were actually ex-communists. They're ex-Trotskyists. They were not Stalinists. But they were Trotskyites in college and then later moved into a type of critical liberalism, which eventually led them to be extremely skeptical of the government interventions of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. And so the Public Interest represented a very skeptical, empirical, and essentially Millerist approach to public policy. That is, Bell, Kristol, and Glaser, and their another friend and contributor and later senator, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, were not, as I mentioned earlier, against the welfare state per se. They felt, though, that the Great Society and subsequent liberal programs were not helping. We're not achieving the desired results. We're not helping the people that these programs are trying to help. And so issue after issue of The Public Interest was devoted to kind of analyzing these social policies and seeing where they went wrong. It later became much more interested in questions of character. And what they found was so much of the success of a public policy depended on the character of the individuals affected by it. And then you had to look at, well, how do we shape character? And that comes down to really the pre-political institutions of family, religion, neighborhood. So that's neoconservatism one. And that neoconservatism had nothing to do with foreign policy. In fact, foreign policy was banned from its pages because the editors had such varying opinions regarding what was then the most important foreign policy issue, the war in Vietnam. However, there's what we might call neoconservatism too, and that's represented by the publication Commentary, founded in 1945 and still ongoing today. I write a monthly column for it. It appears monthly, so I guess I write a column for it. Commentary's longtime editor, Norman Podhoretz, he was 10 years younger than Kristol. Kristol born in 1920, Podhoretz born in 1930, so he's younger. He went to Columbia University, where his mentor was the literary critic Lionel Trilling. Podhoretz was never a Marxist or communist. He was just a liberal in the Trilling mold and more of a literary critic. He becomes editor in 1960. What he finds basically beginning in the 1970s is a deep aversion to basically liberal and radical critiques of the Vietnam War. In his view, these critiques assumed the character of an anti-Americanism, and this repulsed him. And so on the foreign policy there, Podhoretz started basically advocating for a more idealistic American foreign policy, but also one that had serious weight to it in terms of power politics, America's defense expenditures. America should not come home, in the words of George McGovern. And neoconservatism, too, was really a protest against McGovernism in its foreign policy dimension, but also in its domestic dimension, which was basically encapsulated in what was called the new politics of the student rebellion and counterculture. So Podhoretz became a neoconservative, one might say, by Vietnam abroad and radicalism abroad, but also the counterculture at home. And this led to basically support from Ronald Reagan in 1980, because Reagan, to the commentary crowd, represented a much more fulsome American foreign policy, one that was going to not only try to contain the Soviets, but also push them back and eventually defeat them. Finally, and I know I've gone on for a while, but finally, there's Neoconservatism 3, which is one that you're, I think, referring to in your question. And that's the neoconservatism represented by the Weekly Standard magazine, edited by Bill Kristol until 2016, and then edited by Stephen F. Hayes for its last few years. Basically, it published between September 1995 and December 2018. What's funny about it is that at the time that the Standard was founded, neoconservatism was kind of considered passé, because Irving Kristol, Bill's dad, and Norman Podhoretz had more or less just become regular conservatives. And in fact, Podhoretz writes in 1996 an essay called Neoconservatism, a Eulogy, saying all that we stood for, basically the historical conditions that led us to our political views have dissipated, and we are more or just less been incorporated into the conservative mainstream, such as it was. What happens very quickly, though, is that Bill Kristol and his kind of co-author and influential contributing editor to the Standard, Robert Kagan, become associated with a foreign policy that they describe as neo-Reaganite, which basically is a foreign policy of interventionism in the service of American ideals and democracy promotion. They have a reference to, I think, benign hegemony in one of the fundamental essays they wrote describing their position. And this is the form of neoconservatism that becomes associated with the Iraq War of 2003. And that's the neoconservatism that Donald Trump really campaigned against, the interventionism that he campaigned against in 2016 and repudiated. And what's funny is that the Kristol Kagan position on the Iraq War in 2003 was, in fact, the consensus view of the American foreign policy community and the Republican Party. George W. Bush, who actually launched the war, was not a neoconservative of any iteration. So this was a much more conventional opinion in 2003, in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks of 2001, than I think is remembered today. At the moment, as you say, the Weekly Standard doesn't exist, and Kristol is the most prominent never-Trumper. And so they exist probably on the margins of the conservative movement and the Republican Party. But so much depends, I think, on whether Donald Trump is reelected to the future of this version of neoconservatism. It is very possible, in fact, likely, that there will be a fourth neoconservatism, because just the way politics works, people change their views over time. And people might start on the left and end up on the right, and others might start on the right and end up on the left.
So I think I'm glad you brought up George W. Bush and the Iraq War, because a bunch of people have been kind of talking about how, you know, at CPAC and at other places, it appears as if the George W. Bush administration has been memory-holed, so to speak. You know, you saw people talking about Trump being the most pro-life Republican president we've had, which made a lot of, you know, I think Dave Weigel said on Twitter, you know, like, what the hell happened for those 8 years of the Bush administration? And I think that that really gets to something about how the Bush administration, for many, I think, people who think of themselves as being conservatives, but of kind of the more Trumpian ilk of conservatives, the Bush administration has become in some ways part of, even though George W. Bush, as you say, was not a neocon, the Bush administration has become kind of part of neocon parlance, that was part and parcel with neoconservatism. And I've written before, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago for the New York Times on the term conservative. And something I've noticed is that Tucker Carlson wrote in Politico early in 2016 that Republican voters seem to know a lot about Trump more than the people who run their party. They know he isn't a conventional ideological conservative. They seem relieved. And I wanted to ask you how much of the support for Trump from people who think of themselves as being conservative was in some way a reaction to the Republican Party apparatus and what they may view of the of that apparatus's support for kind of the Bush administration's foreign policy and kind of this neoconservative ideal. Because it seemed to me that a lot of people who are very supportive of Trump, how much they strongly dislike many members of the Republican Party is because it seemed as if the Republican Party's base and the Republican Party's kind of thought leaders, so to speak, seemed to have a massive disconnect.
Right. That was clearly revealed in 2016 and what happened there. I think so much depends on how the public views the success or failure of a given presidency. Ronald Reagan was viewed as a successful president. Indeed, even for a time, it was just by Republicans and conservatives. But by the moment where you have Barack Obama in 08 talking about how he in some ways wanted to emulate Reagan's influence over the course of politics, you can see that even Reagan's critics recognized his successes in some ways. So Reagan was viewed as a success. Indeed, he in many ways, George H.W. Bush's election in 1988 is considered the third term of Ronald Reagan. George W. Bush, I would say, at the moment, is viewed as a failure. And I think that that view is not only limited to his liberal critics, who were fierce throughout his presidency, but also increasingly many conservatives as well as Republican voters. This is a presidency whose second term in particular, between 2005 and 2009, with Obama's inauguration, was just one crisis after another. And in some ways, Bush's presidency irritated various segments of conservatism. If you had been going back to Hayek, a more classically liberal, limited government conservative, you were upset about the rise in government spending under the Bush administration. If you were a religious conservative, it's true, you would have liked plenty of George Bush's policies. You would have liked the way he discussed religion in the public sphere. You would have liked his personal comportment. But you would have maybe become a little distrustful of him beginning in 2004, when he only reluctantly and late in the campaign backed the Federal Marriage Amendment. This would be the constitutional amendment forbidding same-sex marriage. And then in 2005, he nominates Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. You become very suspicious of him then. So you begin to have some doubts about him. If you're a foreign policy conservative, you're probably going to have criticisms of him. Remember, the Republican Party traditionally has been associated with realism in foreign affairs and actually a reluctance to engage in overseas conflict. So there were plenty of conservatives and Republicans who were skeptical of the Iraq intervention, but supported it because of the exigencies of the time. And then when the intervention became bogged down in counterinsurgency, there were Republicans and conservatives and neoconservatives who were critical of the conduct of the war. And finally, you know, also if you're a limited government type, you'd be upset over the response to the financial crisis and the bailouts. And then two, if you're a populist conservative, if you're really growing out of the new right tradition of the 1970s, you're going to be upset at George W. Bush's two attempts at comprehensive immigration reform in his second term, as well as his kind of free trade policies, the Central American Free Trade Act, and as well his push for the Dubai ports deal. So I'd say by the time that George W. left office, he had alienated himself from many people within the Republican Party. Let's not forget one reason that the current president's approval ratings remain within that band in the mid to low 40s is because he retains strong approval among the Republican Party. He hasn't alienated Republican voters in the same way that George W. had done by the end of his second term.
You know, and I think that it's something to be said about, you know, when I write about conservatism, there are a lot of people who respond to me with kind of like, okay, you know, you're talking about this ideological conservatism. You're talking about the ideas that people are discussing and arguing about. But what are they doing on the ground? And what are, you know, what are base conservatives thinking? And I think we start to see this conversation taking that turn when we talk about populism. And I know you brought up kind of the new right, but I want to read a paragraph from Ross Douthat at his New York Times column. I was talking about the era of limited government is over. For years now, conservative critics and sociologists and intellectuals have been acknowledging that the answers might be no, that the country's once rich associational and civic and religious life is declining and dissolving, that corporate America embraces conservative slogans to keep taxes low and unions weak, but otherwise seems post-patriotic and performatively woke, that the silent majority of hardworking, pious, culturally conservative blue-collar families is now essentially defunct. He's talking in about kind of the rise of populism and the, you know, Tucker Carlson, a bunch of other folks on the right, having these conversations about, like, maybe the government should be doing more. Maybe the government, you know, what is the purpose of government? Maybe it should be intervening to make family life specifically easier for, quote unquote, normal Americans. And I will leave it up to others to decide what some mean by normal Americans. But I think about CPAC a lot as kind of, you know, the base's message to the world of conservatism. And, you know, we've shifted from a time in which Ron Paul, a deeply libertarian former presidential candidate, won multiple straw polls at CPAC to CPAC being a place where, one, you know, everyone's generally focused on Trump, but where this populist messaging is much more popular. And I kind of want you to take us back a little bit to kind of that new right of the 1970s, but then this emergence of populism and kind of populist attitudes that seems to be a direct rebuke of not just the Bush administration, but kind of elite conservatism.
Right. I mean, just in terms of the Bush administration, one would say that it was not necessarily a small government administration. So if you're rebuking the Bush administration, you might want to be a small government type. And of course, I think the shift that Ross is describing in some ways from the Tea Party conservatism, which it kind of talked about the 10th Amendment, talked about the limited government, states' rights against federal power, talked about shrinking government and such, and now has embraced Donald Trump, who is, the budgets he has submitted cut spending. They're just not going to be enacted into law. What I think revealing of the Tea Party was from those protests, you know, this idea that was mocked at in times by the press, which was that sign that one Tea Partier held up saying, keep your hands off my Medicare. Now, this reveals there that even in these limited government movements, there is a reluctance to take on the core institutions of the welfare state. And this is a long-running thing in American politics. I think it's George Will who likes to say that, you know, Americans are rhetorically Jeffersonian, but operationally Hamiltonian. We like to talk about limited government, but at the end of the day, we want our benefits, and we like things pretty much the way they are. We're small C conservative. We don't want to see radical change. The New Right movement in the 1970s, which I think is connected a lot to the Trump movement, really came out from exactly that, a rebellion against government intervention in family life, in the most private decisions involving contraceptives, reproduction, where your kids go to school. And then, of course, a sense of violated personal security that came with the rise in crime during the decade, consumption of drugs among the youth. The new right leaders like Phyllis Schlafly, Richard Viguerie, Paul Weyrich, and then theorists such as Kevin Phillips and Patrick Buchanan were able to associate all of these things with federal government intervention. And so we were able to direct that protest against the federal government. In many ways, this strain of populism predates the 1970s. You can see it in the support for Joseph McCarthy in the beginning of the 50s. And it also postdates it. I think there are ways that you can understand Ronald Reagan's appeal as a populist, not just a limited government conservative. And then, of course, there's Trump, who is a populist through and through.
So I think that gets back to kind of a baseline question that I've had while doing this work is, if conservatives don't agree on what makes someone conservative or what conservatism really is, then what good is it to discuss whether or not a particular candidate is conservative? Because at some point, you know, you kind of get into that messy area in which either no one is a conservative or everyone's kind of a conservative. And I think that that came up a lot, you know, when you saw the never Trumpers or Trump skeptical Republicans talking about Trump, you know, saying like he's never voiced any conservative views. I've written this, and a lot of people did, that, for example, on social conservative issues, say abortion, Trump's views seem to be kind of what you would think conservatives would say if you had never encountered any. Some might remember Trump's interview with Chris Matthews, I think in 2015, in which he said that women who had abortions should be punished. And the response he got from anti-abortion groups was like, no, that's not what we think. That's not what we think. But it didn't seem to matter that his internal conservatism was of no real... It didn't matter to people who think of themselves as being deeply conservative. So, you know, and I think that there are a lot of folks on the left who are kind of like, all we do is argue about who's more liberal than who and who is more like, and, you know, they look at the right and they're like, they nominated this guy and he won the presidency while not adhering to the views we've been told that are conservatism. So, you know, where does that leave us? Where does it leave us in the story of conservatism when no one can really agree on who gets to be a conservative?
I actually think Trump ran much more of as a conservative than maybe other conservatives I know think. Let me explain why. I was there. I followed Trump in 2011 when he was flogging the birther thing and thinking of running for president. And I went with, was there in New Hampshire when he visited. And I was struck by a few things. One was just how much attention he drew to himself and the whole media scrum. I was also struck by two more things. One was that was same day that he visited New Hampshire was when the Obama administration released the long form certificate. And we were at the diner. Trump was visiting at a diner in New Hampshire. I think it was Robert Gibbs at that point. I could be wrong. Could have been Jay Carney. But they come out with the birth certificate on television. And Trump was in a private meeting when that actually happened. So we were all interested in the press. Well, how is he going to react when he sees this on the TV? So he came out of the private room. He looked at it on the TVs. His chin jutted out, you know, in that lower lip expression he always has. And then he turned to us and he said, he wouldn't have done it without me. And you saw there with Trump's ability to immediately adapt and always take credit for whatever is happening. The second thing that struck me was at that same diner. He then moves back out into the crowd in order to greet, mix it up with the patrons of the diner. And I just happened to be, just because it was so crowded in there, somehow the crowd pushes me to where I'm literally as far away from Trump as I am from you now, but we're in front of a booth of kind of looks like retirees of New Hampshire. I mean, I don't know who else would be there in the middle of the day or whatever. And Trump assumes the same thing I did, because as he's talking to them and smiling, he goes, not going to touch Social Security, am I, guys? So he knew then, too, that the push in some quarters to not only protest the Great Society, but also to try to dissect or deconstruct the New Deal was just a non-starter in American politics. At that same time in 2011 was when Donald Trump announced he was pro-life. And I think that move, in retrospect, was the beginning of him really seriously thinking of running for president. He ended up not running in 2012, of course, but he obviously did in 2016. And he understood that he could not, unlike probably from watching his friend Rudy Giuliani a few years earlier run and fail, he would not be able to win the nomination of the Republican Party without being a pro-life candidate. So that happens in 2011. What else does he do? Well, he becomes a firm supporter of Second Amendment rights throughout the 2016 campaign. He becomes a devoted supply-sider, a tax cutter. That, you know, he has Larry Kudlow and Stephen Moore write his campaign proposal, Art Laffer, the founders of Supply Side. And then, of course, now he has Larry Kudlow chair his council of the National Economic Council. So pro-life, Second Amendment, tax cuts. Okay, well, I'm starting to see a theme. These are all very conservative positions. What does he do when Justice Scalia dies suddenly? Well, very quickly, he works with the Federalist Society to come up with a list of originalist judges that he promises to nominate to the bench. Oh, okay, if you're a social conservative or a constitutionalist, that's pretty good. Well, where does he depart from the Republican elites? Mainly, it's on that question of intervention, which by that point in 2016, as you point out, even most Republicans had shifted toward Trump. It was on the question of trade, where it was always unusual that Republican support for free trade was much softer than was reflected in the party's upper echelons. And then it was finally in immigration, but you know, immigration was an issue on which he was much closer to the Republican voters than, say, the Republican Senate was, because Marco Rubio had tried to,
right,
once again, to work with Chuck Schumer and President Obama in 2013 to get comprehensive immigration reform and failed. And part of that was just a total absence of support for this plan in the Republican-held House. So I think on all these issues, Trump was actually running as a conservative. For me, the critique of Trump during that campaign that was substantive was the one about his character and lack of experience. And that, of course, was overruled by the electorate on election day, or ignored, or politely kind of avoided.
It seems interesting to me that by taking on not necessarily kind of the underpinnings of those belief systems, you know, not having a deep, let's say, you know, a deep biblical understanding of the issues of life, not having a, you know, I was deeply enmeshed in the gun rights issue and I have a very complicated view of Heller or something like that, but just by able to say, like, I am pro-life because that's what voters like. I am pro-Second Amendment because that's what voters like. I am pro-supply-side economic theory because that's what I've been told voters like. He was able to assume the mantle of conservatism without having to do any of the work of being a conservative.
Well, I think that was because so many Republican voters had basically conceived of the problem as this, which is for decades they had supported politicians who could give all of the eloquent explanations that you refer to, but then never really did anything for them as soon
right,
as they
that
were
kind in, of like, what have you conserved? Because I think that that's something, you know, I've always been interested that the growth of the so-called alt-right, a lot of their ire was not aimed at the left, but at the right for not having, quote unquote, conserved anything. And I'm using air quotes, which doesn't really make any sense
on a podcast,
but just imagine I am doing air quotes.
There was a feeling that the Republican leadership had failed the Republican voter. This comes up again and again. It's part of the reason that Ronald Reagan was able to come as close as he did to defeating Gerry Ford for the nomination in 1976. And it was one reason why Goldwater was able to basically be drafted and winning the nomination in 64. The Republican voters become skeptical of their leadership. And so this manifests itself every so often in a desire for people who are kind of out of that leadership, or who come from outside, and that was clear. That was clear as early as 2015 that the outsider candidate would do well. It just happened to be Trump. I almost think that there's something similar happening in liberal and progressive circles now, in relation to the 2020 nomination. That there's a desire for, you know, somebody other than the same old options, for someone new. And that could maybe lead to unexpected results, just as it did 2 years ago.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit Mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.
So I wanted to, you know, you've done a lot of work on Ronald Reagan, and it's interesting to me that Ronald Reagan holds such a giant place in conservative memory, you know, not necessarily because of what he did, because I think that there are a lot of Reagan's policies, and I think it comes up a lot when you talk to kind of the immigration hawk conservatives who were still very upset about Reagan's immigration policies from the mid-1980s. But not what he did, but what he meant to the conservative movement. Do you see that changing or shifting in any way? Because I think that, you know, he's now taken on this place in which it's not necessarily about who he was, but what he meant to the movement.
It might be shifting. I think Trump has basically risen to Reagan's level in the eyes of many conservatives. And I know that might stun a lot of the audience, but if Trump wins re-election, he will be at the same level as Reagan, I think, in the minds of a lot of Republicans. How often do Democrats look back at FDR? I mean, there is just this problem as you get further removed from the presidency, maybe you think about it a little bit less. Now, it's not a problem for me because I'm an amateur historian. But so Ronald Reagan and FDR are probably, in my view, the two most important presidents of the 20th century. One created the New Deal. The other significantly modified it in some ways or shifted the course of events. And I think it's interesting that, you know, I mentioned Obama earlier and his reference to Reagan in 2008, where he said he wanted to be a president as influential as Reagan. I don't think that's actually the way it worked out. I mean, Obama was able to achieve the Affordable Care Act, and that seems to be a durable part of his legacy, at least, again, under the modifications that have been made to it, and they've been significant ones, most recently with the abandonment of the mandate. But nonetheless, something like the ACA will hold. The other aspects of Obama's legacy were very infirm, and Trump has basically dismantled all of them. Trump's significance is real. Ronald Reagan, one of the things that fascinates me about Ronald Reagan is I feel he's kind of like Superman. He's this alien being that kind of landed in the middle of Kansas and just took over the conservative movement. He didn't become a Republican until he was 51 years old. He was an FDR Democrat. He has a note in his diary where he says, you know, I'm being attacked as someone who's out to repudiate FDR, but they don't understand. I voted for FDR four times, and my real goal is to oppose the Great Society, not the New Deal. And yet Reagan always had this belief that, look, if you share my ideas, good, join me. I'm not necessarily going to share yours. And so he was able to appeal to a wide variety of people as long as they bought into the central Reaganite premise. And what is that premise? It has to do with American exceptionalism. It has to do with America as the last stand for freedom on the earth. And it has to do, and something he brings up in several speeches, which I find fascinating, Reagan doesn't think of politics in terms of left or right. He thinks of it in terms, it's not horizontal axis, it's the vertical axis. It's control or lack of control. Are you being able to maximize the choice in your life and become the individual you want to be? Or are you being pushed down by central authority? This is a remarkable way to view politics in my opinion. And it lends itself to I think, a wide appeal. And also allows himself to become populist, because if the central authority is encroaching on your life in various ways, well, then that populist rebellion is something that he is going to be able to capture the energy of. So I think it's important, even if Reagan might be in the process of being eclipsed by Donald Trump in the Republican Party and conservative movement, I think it's very important for conservatives to go back to Reagan and think about him seriously, not just as a successful politician, which he was, but as a political thinker, which no one really gives him credit for. But it's remarkable to me the continuity of his thought, even when he was a liberal Democrat, to the day he said his goodbye to America and his, you know, 1994 revelation that he had Alzheimer's.
So I'm glad you brought up the idea of American exceptionalism, because I think that was something that for a lot of conservatives who have opposed Trump, kind of the never Trumpers, the fact that Trump had no adherence to American exceptionalism whatsoever, and just repeatedly said things like, we've done things just as bad as they have, which, you know, it's one of those things that, like, that is both true and also generally not what conservative politicians talk about. And yet that seemed to be something that maybe it was taken kind of like, well, you know, you take this along with the things we like about Trump, or it was something that really, I think, appealed in some sense to kind of the foreign policy realists of conservatism. So can you talk about that? Because it seems as if in many ways, Trump is stands in direct opposition to that view of America, you know, kind of the It's Morning in America 1984 version of Ronald Reagan.
Yes, this is Trump's comfort with strongmen is new and unusual. The type of person that appeals to, I don't think, constitute a majority of Republicans or even conservatives. There's definitely a minority on the right that does like that. I'm not sure how numerous they are. It's one of those aspects of Trump that I think discomfits a lot of Republicans whenever he says something like, oh, we're just as bad, or we do that too, or I take Kim Jong-un at his word, you know. I mean, it would take a team of experts to psychologize Donald Trump, and I'm against psychologizing him. I would just say I think sometimes he says these things because he views himself in a process of continual negotiation with tough guys. And so he's like doing a solid for Kim Jong-un to say, oh, I take you at your word. If Trump is reelected, there will be changes to the Republican Party as we understood it up until 2016. I think right now we're in this moment of flux where he is remarkably popular among Republicans and among large parts of the conservative movement, even if still viewed skeptically by most conservative intellectuals. And we're not sure how the story is going to turn out. If he's a one-term president and viewed more as a Jimmy Carter than a Ronald Reagan, well, I think you will find that conservatism and republicanism go back to a slight modification of the pre-Trump status quo. If Trump is reelected and he becomes a two-term president, then, like I say, I think he'll be viewed as nipping at Reagan's heels as the central Republican slash conservative political figure of our era. And you will begin to, I think you begin to see changes in the Republican posture towards things such as border security, immigration reform, and trade, those, as well as foreign policies. Those were the three parts where Trump was always most at odds with Republican elites: immigration, trade, and America's role in the world. And we're seeing him struggle against Republicans in Congress over these issues, if you consider the fact that there's conservative opposition in the Senate to his emergency declaration on the border. The Senate has already expressed its skepticism of his tariffs and trade wars. And, of course, also the recent McConnell amendment saying that we should not precipitously withdraw from Afghanistan. If Trump wins a second term, I do think you'll see a turn of the party toward his positions. Who is elected matters, and the nominees and or the presidents do change their party. And that's for me is the real question here. Is Trump's relation to the Republican Party like Jimmy Carter's or like Ronald Reagan's? I have to say at this point in his term, it's more like the latter.
So I think now is the time at which you offer our listeners three book recommendations, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what you recommend.
Well, it's great. The conversation took a turn away from what I thought we were going to discuss. So let me just start with the book on neoconservatism, which is called Neoconservatism by Irving Kristol. It's still in print. You should be able to find it on Amazon. It was published in 1995. That's the best introduction, I think, to what neoconservatism was, is, in its first iteration. Another book that's, I think I just mentioned him once in this conversation, but I do think is important for people to understand kind of the fault line in American conservatism between those who think the Declaration of Independence is central to the American founding and those who believe that the Constitution is more important. And this is Jaffa's basically analysis of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And Jaffa comes on the side of the proposition. He's the propositionalist. That is to say, when Lincoln speaks at Gettysburg of the proposition that we are a government devoted to the proposition that all men are created equal, this is the most important part of the founding. And this is a controversial position within American conservatism. And there's an ongoing debate about, is that really true? Is the Declaration really as central as we're taught? Is saying you're created equal lead inexorably to a desire for substantive equality? I think it's an important book. It's also a fantastic book to read. And then if you're interested in populism and the new right and kind of the roots of where Donald Trump came from, I recommend a book by Patrick Buchanan. It came out in 2017. It's called Nixon's White House Wars. And it's a fascinating history of the Nixon presidency by a man who was his right-hand man. And it gives a look into things such as Nixon's so-called Southern strategy, get to the beginnings of the critique of the mainstream media, which was really through Nixon's first vice president, Spiro Agnew, in a series of speeches Buchanan wrote for
Did
Agnew.
Did Buchanan write Nattering Nabobs of Negativism?
No, that phrase was written actually by William Safire.
Okay.
The other Nixon speechwriter who was the liberal conservative Nixon speech. Nixon had a set of speechwriters. There was the conservative Buchanan. There was kind of the libertarian liberal conservative Safire. And then there was the liberal Republican Ray Price. See, he would, depending on what speech, he would have a different guy write the speech. Buchanan, and I think Tim Alberta Politico did a great piece on him. All the controversy surrounding Buchanan, he really does emerge and has emerged in kind of the background of the Trump administration. He's emerges a very important conservative thinker, perhaps not given his due, and maybe sometimes for good reason not given his due. But it is actually a very good work of history that he wrote in 2017.
I've always thought that Buchanan's 1992 Republican National Convention speech was a lot more telling than I think a lot of people have let on, and a lot more influential on specifically kind of where a portion of the conservative base was thinking and would think to go on a lot of issues.
You know, it's funny about that speech. It was polled right after he gave it, and the initial polling was quite supportive of the culture war speech. By the end of the week, the media had really attacked it, and the polling began to shift. And of course, George H.W. Bush, who Buchanan had kind of challenged, was very upset because it ran against his whole theory of, you know, 1,000 points of light and a kinder, gentler nation.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew Continetti of the Washington Free Beacon, for joining me. It's been a really interesting and enjoyable conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you to Matthew for being here. Thank you to our producer and engineer, Jeff Geld. And as loyal Vox Media Network podcast listeners, we have a request for you. We want to hear what you have to say about our podcasts, what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, what we should stop doing, and what we should do more of. So visit voxmedia.com/podsurvey to take the survey and tell us what you think. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production. We will be back in a couple of days.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.